From WBUR Boston, I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. A new wardrobe, shiny convertible, steamy affair. Sound like symptoms of a man experience a midlife crisis? Could be, or it could be a middle-aged woman, adrift after decades of trying to juggle too much at work and at home. Tonight on Point, women leaping over the edge, the female midlife crisis. But first, we begin tonight with the latest on Amtrak's many woes. Amtrak pulled the only high-speed Acela train still operating on the weekend out of service today. Friday, it suspended Acela service between Washington and Boston after inspectors found problems with the train's brakes. This comes as the Bush administration weighs whether to force Amtrak into bankruptcy, which would trigger a massive restructuring of the country's passenger rail service. Keith Alexander covers transportation for The Washington Post and joins me now. Hello, Keith.
Hello, how are you?
So, how serious a setback is this brake problem for Amtrak?
Well, this brake problem is a very serious setback. I mean, the Acela is one of Amtrak's premier products. It's a product that is 5 years old. It's the one that attracted mostly business travelers who are willing to pay a premium price to ride between Washington and New York and New York and Boston.
That's a pretty successful route, isn't it?
Very successful route. Again, it's really lined with business travelers. And again, business travelers are willing to pay top dollar. So this is not a good deal for Amtrak, which has been struggling financially for quite some time.
Any idea of how long the trains will be out of service?
Well, Amtrak tried to run one train yesterday and hoping that they can get some of the trains out there, but they pulled that train. And so now they're looking at making a decision on Friday. So between all this week, all the trains have been suspended, but they're hoping to at least resume service sometime within the next couple of weeks, is what I'm told.
Okay. Now, the timing of all this is for Amtrak, what's the word I'm looking for? Poor.
is very poor for Amtrak. Again, Amtrak has been struggling financially. Amtrak is subsidized financially a great deal by the government.
Federal government.
Right, federal government. And the leaders of Amtrak have said that not enough money is coming in, and Amtrak has already been saying that they've had to cut some of its routes if they don't get more money. So it's going to be interesting to see what happens over the next few weeks, if not months, if the Acela does not come back.
Now, the Bush administration is actually floating an idea that it would pull funding for Amtrak altogether, is it not?
That's correct. That was part of the latest fiscal proposal that has to be decided on quite soon. David Gunn, who's the leader of Amtrak, the chairman and CEO, has said that if that happens, then Amtrak will drastically have to reduce much of its service, particularly some of its long-haul service, coast to coast.
Well, what is the federal government thinking there by pulling the funding? How will Amtrak make it work if it can't make it work now without federal government money?
Well, what they're saying is that Amtrak probably does need to cut back some of its service and really focus on some of its more profitable routes and also possibly raise some of its rates and raise some of its fares on some of those routes. The Bush administration has said that Amtrak really does not need as much federal subsidy as it is getting. So we just need to see what happens.
And maybe it has some of those routes because it has those routes in order to get congressional approval.
Just like the airlines, correct. Airlines have gotten a lot of federal monies over since 9/11, and a lot of the routes that are being flown are in a lot of congressional districts. A lot of airlines are based in a lot of congressional districts, and so I think that's also an issue as well.
Well, there does seem to be a point there to be made, though. You bring up things like airlines, that it's hard to run a national transportation service in this country without some help from somebody.
So that seems to be the case, and we're going to see what happens. Again, Amtrak is going to be a very interesting case model over the next few months. As you know, we talked to David Gunn on last Friday, the day that Amtrak pulled the Acela, and we asked that very question. And he said that this is more of an indication just how much money is needed to maintain this service.
Well, rail passengers will be sitting around with fingers crossed, no doubt. Keith, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Keith Alexander is transportation reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with me from Washington. The The Wall Street Journal's work and family columnist, Sue Schellenberger, didn't know what came over her. Her marriage ended in divorce. She felt a sudden need to break loose, to play hooky from a job she loved, to stop being the ultra-responsible mother, maybe to drive too fast in all-terrain vehicles. When she wrote about her midlife crisis in a column, she got an overwhelming response. She was on to something. Women, now financially more independent than ever before, with confidence from years of work, are experiencing midlife crises because, Schellenberger concluded, they could. Tonight on Point, middle-aged women leaping over the edge, the female midlife crisis. You can join the conversation. When you reached middle age, women, did you plunge headfirst into a midlife crisis? Is that the right word? What set it off? Did you go back to school, have an affair, buy a car? We're here at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from New York is Sue Schellenberger, creator and writer of the Wall Street Journal's Work and Family column. Her new book is The Breaking Point: How Female Midlife Crisis is Transforming Today's Women. Hello, Sue.
Hello, Jennifer.
Also with me in studio is Nancy Kane, tonight's On Point News analyst. She's a professor at Harvard Business School and a business historian. Welcome, Nancy.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Sue, I'd like to start with you because I know that this book, a very personal effort, had a very personal beginning. You literally and figuratively, I guess, flipped out at one point, and it involved an accident with an all-terrain vehicle. Tell us about the genesis of your book.
It did indeed. I had gone through a series of losses at midlife, as so many of us do, and as you detailed so well, and I found myself at a turning point. I felt a sense of emotional deadness. I felt a sense of wanting to find new meaning to sustain me. I felt mortality looming ahead. And I wanted to explore my own limits. For me, that emerged as a desire for adventure, for wilderness escapades. And I did take up all-terrain vehicle riding, partly because I couldn't keep a motorcycle upright. Flipped it, nearly killed myself, wound up in the emergency room. My doctor's first words were, "Not again." I had multiple accidents on those vehicles, but they took me places where I wasn't able to get otherwise, deep into the wilderness where I could find a sense of peace.
I want to start, throw this right out there, because it's in the title of your book, and it's a label, and I know that Nancy Kane is going to want to address this at some point, too. I just want to challenge this for a second, because one of the phrases that comes up throughout your book, from the 50 women that who took part in this with interviews with you, they all said again and again, "This is my last chance to," and then fill in the blank. My last chance to find a soulmate, to run my own business, to raft the Colorado, whatever. And some of the changes these women make are really big, but is crisis the word we want to use? Sue?
I questioned this, Jennifer, and was uncomfortable with it from the beginning. However, researchers for the MacArthur Foundation Project found that the term midlife crisis carries a lot of meaning for Americans. And when you ask Americans, what does it mean to you to have a midlife crisis, they define it quite differently from what researchers have done in the past. They say it's a time of transition brought on by significant life events that often changes their life's direction. And this, in fact, defines a much broader, deeper, more psychological renewal than we've been led to believe in the past about midlife crisis. In other words, I'm trying to set forth a new definition.
Right, I was just about to say, fair enough, but that's not what we think, I think, when we see it on the cover of a book. Nancy, do you have a point you want to make about this?
Yeah, I think that, I agree with what Sue's saying now, and I think crisis is it's a trigger word for a lot of associations to emergency, to danger, to threat. And what I hear you saying, Sue, and what I read in the book and what I think of as I look at your survey data and your interview data is an opportunity in many ways, an opportunity engendered by loss, losses that are not uncommon when one reaches one's 40s or 50s just by death and demographics and the life process, but an opportunity, a door opening in some sense, in different ways and with different rooms beyond for different people, but an opportunity rather than a kind of surprising tragedy or problem.
Okay, fair enough. I wanted to get that label on the table because I knew that we all had opinions about it, and there, now, we've all shared them. Sue, in your book, you say that this happens to, or you're finding in the research, that it's happening to women more than men. Is that right?
That's right. The first systematic scientific look at how Americans perceive midlife crisis showed that 36.1% of women believe they have had one by their early 50s, 34% of men. Thus, women are having them at a higher frequency than men.
Any idea on why?
Well, I think there's a couple of things happening. Women are empowered to have them now. Women's real income has risen 16.8% in the past 15 years, while men's has fallen by nearly 2%. Women now hold more than half of all college degrees, more than half of the professional jobs, and nearly half of the managerial jobs. So women are empowered to act out their desires at midlife. They tend to be more self-expressive, and the research also shows that they have had to repress some of their dreams to a greater extent than men during their childbearing years. Researchers actually asked this question about the rate of dream fulfillment and found that women go through a deeper dip in their childbearing years and rearing years, and then a bigger rebound at midlife.
So is this emotionally, emotionally you're talking about?
It's as defined by positive answers to the question, you know, how many dreams have you fulfilled in your life in the last 5 years?
Okay.
And those are defined as new relationship, property, career, a goal, a life goal achieved.
Nancy Kane, I know you want to address this question of income, but we're just going to pause here for a moment and we'll come back to it after the break. We're talking tonight about the female midlife crisis, or maybe crisis isn't quite the right word. A taking of stock. You can join the conversation. Is the female midlife all that different from the males or not? Is there something selfish about the midlife crisis? Do we just want too much for ourselves? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the female midlife crisis, when decades of keeping up with work and family send women to the edge. Women, what sent you into some introspection while your friends sailed so smoothly on? Men, have the women around you abandoned work and family, maybe even you, in midlife for something new? We are at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with Sue Shellenbarger, creator and writer of the Wall Street Journal's Work and Family column. Her new book is The Breaking Point: How Female Midlife Crisis is Transforming Today's Women. And with Nancy Kane, tonight's On Point News analyst. She is a professor at Harvard Business School and a business historian. Nancy, as promised before we went to the break, I wanted to turn that income question over to you, because there's a sense here that women are making big changes at midlife in this generation because they can.
Well, I think that Virginia Woolf wrote many, many years ago about a room of one's own, meaning that women's power had something to do with women's voice. And I think women's economic power, earning their own income, has always had very important ripple effects socially, psychologically, practically in society. And there have been three periods when women poured into the workforce with an income of their own. In the late 19th century, with the beginning of office work and factory work, and then the repercussions from that were the vote, birth control, flappers, a whole new sense of women's role in society, of their sexual identity. Then in the Second World War, when the men went off to the front, the women, Rosie the Riveter and all her sisters, poured into the factories. And out of that came, by the late 1950s and early 1960s, a whole range of important statements and stakes put in the ground about women's power, from Betty Friedan's, you know, the feminine mystique in the early 1960s, to the beginnings of what today we call the women's liberation movement by the mid-1960s. Mm-hmm. And then the floodgates gave way in the late 1970s and 1980s, and women poured into the paid workforce, resulting in the kind of numbers that Sue was just talking about. Over 70% of women in America work today. Most of those women work full-time. Economic agency and action has conveyed voice, power, a wish for a lot of things that women three generations ago didn't feel they had the right to claim. And in that sense, I think a lot of this has to go back literally to the paycheck, even though there's social and psychological effects, go back to the paycheck and women's expanding roles.
an empowering paycheck, and it comes with some strings. Sue, if I can come back to you here, how is this different from what our mothers went through? There's a question raised in your book, and it's really interesting, about how something like the introspection at midlife would be viewed as some sort of a medical or mental problem, even a generation ago.
That's very true. I think too often in the past, very broad and deep psychological renewal and rebirth was written off as the symptoms of menopause. And in fact, fewer than 1% of women attribute their midlife crises to menopause. It is, for most women, a benign, if troubling, event. In the past, I think women certainly had turbulence at midlife. We'll never know to what extent they did. We do know that many of them tried for the first time to move into the workplace in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. My own mother went back to school to finish her college degree. We know that women tried to make big changes, but we don't understand to what extent it was it occurred. And I think it's arguably far deeper and broader in this generation.
I wonder if there is a way to get at, though, how many women of that time were medicated for things like depression, when in fact it wasn't the symptoms that needed treating, it was the root causes of it?
I think it's hard to say. I think what happened to them and their families, there are certainly a lot of anecdotal evidence that women were just dismissed. They could go through these incredibly turbulent times, and people would just say, oh, she's just menopausal. And the women I've spoken to who studied women of that era on a longitudinal basis said, we know that they went through turmoil. We know they had yearnings and desires that resurfaced. We know they wanted to integrate lost parts of themselves. But we really, you know, it really wasn't as broad or extensive as it is today. And I think one reason is women simply didn't conceive of their lives in as liberated and broad a fashion as we do now.
There wasn't as much that occurred to them as possible. I want to open the phones because we have gazillions of callers. Jane is calling from Millbury, Massachusetts. Hello, Jane.
Hi there.
Do you have a comment or a question for our guests?
I do. I've been working in a career for the last 18 years and without a degree, and I'm finally going back to school to get my degree. And I feel like all the work that I've done has been the factor that's opened the doors for me. I mean, I've used a lot of my network in order to get into college and to get into this degree, and I find it fascinating. But I also have this desire to kind of just chuck it all and do something totally different, really freeing. And it's so interesting that at the very moment when there's so much paying off in my career, I also feel like doing something kind of wild and off the beaten path.
I have to turn that over to Sue, because you tell that story with variation, but nonetheless a common theme throughout your book.
The falling away of old values is so disorienting. In my case, I used to be a pretty frugal, conventional person, worried about what other people thought of me, and my values are entirely different now. That's one of the hallmarks of midlife crisis. As Joseph Campbell said, it's when you reach the top of the ladder and find it's leaning against the wrong wall.
we talked about that earlier, right?
Right. And Jane, it sounds as if you're having one of those awkward meetings of a developmental change when you're ready for something new, and a chronological time when you're ready to advance your career and your education. I'd strongly encourage you to find a good sounding board and reach out to someone you trust, a friend, therapist, counselor, pastor, coworker, and talk this over. Nothing you do is irreversible. You know, you can certainly take either path and come out just fine, but you could be at the beginning of a legitimate midlife change.
Jane, are you still there?
Yes, I am. Thank you.
I'm wondering if you feel that you're alone in going through this, or if you have friends and family of a similar age who might be facing the same kind of thing.
Yeah, that's the beauty of it. I do have a lot of friends and a dear sister who, you know, we explore this together because we are all feeling that same yearning to do something very, very different, very new.
I think Sue Schallenberger might be onto something. Thank you for joining us, Jane. Sue, just when we talk about things like crisis, and sometimes that word is the right one to use because women make changes that are scary, impulsive, really big. And you talk about some of the dangers, in particular an archetype called the lover in your book. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can just expand on that a bit for our listeners on what some of the pitfalls might be of indulging your own teenage male.
Exactly. Well said. Your inner teenage boy can be very risky at this point. You know, Jennifer, one of the reasons I wrote this book was exactly to the point of your question. I was hoping that women would approach this stage with an awareness that they might do crazy things that they would later regret. And the lover is an archetype where this plays out a lot. More women are having extramarital affairs. We know that from the data. We know that more women are initiating divorce. Too often, women blame the easiest and most nearby scapegoat for their midlife change, the husband, the boss, even the kids, and they want to get away. And then they get away and they find they're alone with themselves. It's really dangerous to assume that your early stage feelings are the ones you should trust. What I'm hoping is that women will say, the hardest work I have to do here is on myself, and not have that affair. Think about the people who depend on you and the loved ones nearby, and step back and reevaluate the broader issues you're probably facing.
I have to say, one of the almost spooky aspects of your book was that you recognized a high capacity for self-delusion in women at this time in their lives. At the very point when I'm thinking, oh, okay, I'm supposed to be introspective and really look at what I want, might be the very time when what I'm telling myself is just a pack of hooey.
When your values that you have abided by fall away, there's a vacuum, and there is a very high capacity for self-deception. This is a psychological fact, that therapists have pointed out, at least in some of the psychological research. And the risk there is that you'll lose touch with reality when you begin to see your family and friends baffled by your behavior, as mine certainly were in my case. You've got a clue that maybe you're at sea, and you know it's risky to trust that midlife messiah who walks into your life. I saw so many odd matchings of, you know, between the seaboat captain and the former CEO, or the milkman and the consultant, you know, not the milkman but the carpenter, where, you know, these pairings don't endure. It's very risky, and you can easily repeat the mistakes of the past.
Yeah, someone who looks like your soulmate at full glance. Take into account where you are at this stage in your life and where your head and heart might be at. We have another caller from Brooklyn, New York this time. Jocelyn, welcome.
Yes, hi. I can't say that I've actually been through the full-blown crisis, but definitely felt restless and thinking, what have I been working for? And I'm wondering if some of that has to do with, as young women, we were kind of fed this vision, you know, by our families, by media, of sort of, you know, of the house and the kids and the family and making it, you know, kind of our version of the American dream, and then getting there and living it and finding, well, what is this anyway? You know, this is not fulfilling me. This is not feeding me. And it can be, I mean, it's not so much the economic scenario that you were putting out, but, I mean, that could be part of it too, the dream job.
I almost think things my mother never told me, Jocelyn.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay.
Well, she did, but it didn't sink in. She was kind of a casualty of the sexual revolution, I think.
Nancy Kane, how much of this do you think has to do with this isn't where we expected to be?
It's not where we expected to be. But let's remember, we are talking about massive social change. This is the historical perspective, unprecedented movement in the tectonic plates, if you will, of how we think about our gender roles, of how our families are organized, of how we spend our time, of who earns the money, ultimately of how we spend it in all these two income earner and single mother families. Yeah. It's enormous change, and it's happened because it's happened at white hot speed in less than 20 years. I think one of the very important consequences of all that change is what Jocelyn is alluding to, that women have been buffeted as a result by all kinds of conceptions of what it means to be a woman at the end of the 20th and the beginning of the 21st century. Are we to be great career women? Are we to be loving mothers and partners and members of our community and daughters? Are we to be at peace with ourselves as as members of a polity and a members of a society trying to serve others. Service has always been part of what women do. We have so many more questions than we have answers, and we are and the media tells us that we are to do all of it. And at home, by the way, we're working, all the studies show, women are working a lot harder between home and work than they did 20 years ago. So it's been a bit of a Chinese fire drill for women. And I think one of the effects is documented, or some of these effects are documented in the stories that Sue tells so well in this book.
Sue, I have a caller here. I think you're going to want to listen to what Mary Beth has to say. Mary Beth, you're calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Welcome.
Thank you. I just wanted to say that I do agree with using the word crisis, because I believe I am in the middle of a midlife crisis, and it really does feel indeed like I need to be in crisis mode to try to figure out what to do and how to change this real dissonance that I'm feeling with the choices that I've made.
Can you give us an idea of some of what you're facing, Mary Beth?
Yeah, well, midlife, and, you know, a body that doesn't work quite the way it used to work, and I thought that it was I needed a whole new career, so chucked a really good career and went back to graduate school to try to do something completely different, and now I'm finding after 7 years of training for that this really isn't where I'm supposed to be either. So I'm one of those women who decided not to have children. I have a wonderful marriage, but decided not to have children, and so I thought, oh, well, the world's kind of open to me, but now it feels less open, and just that I really now have to scramble to try to figure out what to do, because it feels like time is ticking.
Sue, I really want to turn that over to you, and also with the point, because one of the reasons I find Mary Beth so interesting is that she's trying to make the change, and at the moment it isn't quite working for her. And there aren't that many examples of that in your book. You have a lot of the good news stories. So I'm interested to hear what you think of Mary Beth's position in her midlife change.
This is a tough one, Mary Beth. My heart really goes out to you. This is and to have invested 7 years in a new career that isn't paying off for you.
Oh, no kidding.
The starting point that you described is one that you share with so many women, and it's you look in the mirror and you see the signs of aging. The MacArthur Foundation study showed that fully 3/5 of women are deeply troubled by the physical signs of aging, and that for many of them, coming to terms with that alone is a huge midlife task. And coming to terms with how we've made decisions about, you know, our biological functions, you know, the love, the kids, the physical appearance, letting go, mourning things. We lose things at midlife, and we gain new things. You know, you're in the process of a very important self-discovery. It can take, I mean, the bad news here is it can take a decade or more to get through this process. You know more now than you did 7 years ago. You know a lot about yourself, probably more than almost any other woman, you know, about career issues in yourself. I would encourage you to give yourself a break, congratulate yourself for making that effort, and say, hey, you know, it can take a long time to get through this. And some of the women in my study actually did have 2 or 3 false starts. So you're not alone in that.
Right. Well, I'm just glad that it's being talked about. I'm glad that your book, I'm going to go out and get it, because I just didn't know other women were going through this to the extent that you're talking about it tonight, and that I feel like I'm going through it. So.
Well, Mary Beth, we thank you for calling. Sue, you have a personal story to tell here, and I have to admit, I laughed out loud when I read it in the book. You were looking for the keys to your all-terrain vehicle, and all you could find were your osteoporosis pills. Which leads me to ask the question, where do you think you are in this midlife evaluation? I mean, you described yourself as the archetype, the adventure seeker label sort of fit you. But are you through this process yourself yet?
And I'm in a much more peaceful final stage.
I don't have to look out for you on the road.
I'm actually riding very safely these days. I haven't flipped my ATV in years.
Excellent.
2 years now, and no more broken bones. I'm happy to say that I still have great challenges in my life. I still have really tough and painful times with my children, with my station in life. What's different is what's inside me. I'm much more at peace with myself. One of the women in my study said midlife is a time when you really have to learn to come to peace with the sound of your own voice and with being alone with your own voice. I can feel that I'm very close to that now. I'm content in myself. I feel complete. And in that, the losses and the challenges I face are easier for me to deal with, frankly. So I'd say I'm probably three quarters of the way through based on what I know about the subject.
I thought that was important for Mary Beth to hear, that the person who actually wrote the book doesn't feel she's 100% through it already anyway. Nancy Kane, I know you want to weigh in on this. I'm going to ask you just to wait a moment. We're going to take another pause and we'll be right back. We're discussing women leaping over the edge, the female midlife crisis, or call it what you will, and how it's changing our society. You can join the conversation. Women, did your midlife change your life for the better, or did it just make things worse? And what could you have done differently to avoid a crisis? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Jennifer Westaway, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Jennifer Westaway, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about middle-aged women, what drives them to crises, and what it says about our society. You can join the conversation. Women, when you reached middle age, did you plunge headfirst into some sort of crisis? If you did, what set it off? Did you go back to school, have an affair, maybe buy a new car? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're speaking with Sue Schellenberger, creator and writer of the Wall Street Journal's Work and Family column. Her new book is The Breaking Point, How Female Midlife Crisis is Transforming Today's Women. And with me in studio is Nancy Kane, tonight's On Point News analyst. She's a professor at Harvard Business School and a business historian. Nancy, I want to throw something to you here, because we were speaking earlier about our mother's generation, and I have a feeling if my mother was listening to this, she'd be horrified. And saying something along the lines of, what is all this me, me, me? You know, where is it written you're supposed to be happy all the time? And are we the baby boomer generation or the generation that simply wants too much?
Well, I think there's a very interesting issue about, you know, whether there is a cohort effect, if you will, in terms of women now in their 40s and 50s. There's a lot of good statistical evidence that suggests that the baby boomer generation, people born before 1961, 62, depending on how you count it, are very, very self-involved. Mm-hmm. More self-involved than people older, matures, people older than they, and more self-involved than Generation Y and X coming up behind them. So I think there's an interesting kind of potential kind of cohort generational issue. But there's a more interesting philosophical question, which is, what does it mean to successfully navigate the transitions in life? Does that make us more interested in the self, more concerned with our own balance sheet of life's good liabilities and assets? Or does it bring us into some kind of more integrated and fuller relationship with others, with the next generation? Generational legacy is an important hallmark of all the psychological theory of midlife transitions, whether they're men or women. Does it bring us into better touch with ourselves, not only as women, but as human beings? Because integrating masculine and feminine is an important part of navigating these kind of moments as well. And finally, what kind of citizens broadly defined, does it make us to navigate a crisis? Do we find a kind of redemptive hope that extends beyond ourselves in these moments? Those are important questions, not just for all of us as social animals, as people who want to make a difference, but also for our society at large.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got a call from Rob from Durham, North Carolina. Rob, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. I got to tell you, I think a lot of this conversation about, you know, middle class crisis is frankly a bunch of pap. I mean, you know, y'all ought to come down to North Carolina. I'll show you a middle class. I'll show you a midlife crisis. We've got people who get tossed out of their textile jobs that have been working in factories for 25 years. Women who, you know, can't find jobs or in anything but fast food, who've had the same job for a generation. you know, plants closing. Those are midlife crisis. The rest of this stuff is, from my perspective anyway, sort of self-indulgent, middle-class women whining about all of the choices they have and the fact that they can't choose. And frankly, I don't think it's just men, women. I think it's men as well. It's sort of a reflection of the culture of self-confession and self-indulgence that we have. And I'm not buying it. And I also think that this book is sort of the worst example of trend journalism, where, you know, you sort of decide what you want to write about or something that's hot, and you ask people a bunch of questions and then call it a trend, and all of a sudden we're reading about it in all these books and all these magazines.
Okay, Rob, stay on the line, would you? I want to turn this over to Sue. A midlife crisis, a luxury for the rich.
There were a significant subset of the women in my study made less than $35,000 a year, and they didn't have the luxury to go out and do a lot of silly, frivolous things, which is something I'm trying to disabuse people of in the book. They had to change their lives where they were at. Their income didn't affect the fact that midlife brings us to a new stage of life. We have a 30-year bonus. We're probably going to live longer than our parents. You know, we have to figure out how we're going to do that. And the second thing is, Rob raises a really good point about the economic dilemma, the vocational dilemma that so many women face. One of the big chunks of this book is about workplace issues, that women reach the 30s and 40s and they find that they are invisible, they're sidelined, men and women alike, because of their age. We're still in a very ageist workplace culture. And this brought on midlife crisis for a significant number of them. The fact that they were either at risk of layoff or they had career setbacks. One woman said, now it's my turn to get the crap kicked out of me, pardon my language, because I'm in my late 40s and this is a young person's job. So Rob raises a really good point, and I think what I tried to do in the book with both the examples and the data, which was a national random study, was to show that these turning points hit people in all sectors of society, and the self-indulgent stage is something that, A, we should know better than to engage in, and B, is only the initial stage.
Nancy Cain?
I couldn't agree with Sue. I think it was Sue more. I think that And I take the point very clearly that, you know, buying a new car, bungee jumping, the kind of, you know, exciting but also frivolous pursuits that Sue describes as some of the symptoms of midlife transitions are not really what's important. And they are certainly the prerogative of people with significant disposable income in many cases. But the issue that Sue's talking about here around the various pressures that people face of all ages in at midlife and how they navigate them is real, whether you make $10,000 a year or whether you make $150,000 mm-hmm. a year. The losses people suffer, the enormous increase in divorce rates, the enormous increase in depression that we see in our society today, those are all real pressures on people. They affect our lives. And so to talk about how women are dealing with those seems to me a very important thing. It may open up the door for men who have statistically been much less willing to talk about these transitions to talk about them as well.
Right. Back to the phones. Heather, calling from Sheboygan, Wisconsin. How'd I do?
Yeah.
Okay.
Perfect. That's how it is. Yeah, I find myself, and I don't know if you have recognized the sort of new demographic that's come up. I call it like the Bridget Jones generation,
mm-hmm.
where all of us in our, you know, in our late 20s and early to mid 30s, you know, we're single, we've got our careers, we've thought, you know, we've carefully chosen careers, and we own our own homes, and we volunteer, and it just, it gets overwhelming at such a young age, and, you know, I know so many of us, and we're not married, and you know, what advice do you have to give? Because I happen to be in a profession where a lot of people come, they're sort of their second time around in their early to mid-40s. I see a lot of women going through their midlife crisis, and this is a career that they come into.
Do you sell real estate by any chance, Heather? What's your career?
No, I'm a massage therapist.
Oh, okay.
And an esthetician. And I see a lot of women that age come into the profession to get more into a very caring, high-touch profession.
Interesting.
And as well as seeing women I know go through it, how do you prepare to make the right changes in your life? I mean, how do you, I don't want to say how do you prevent this from happening, but,
How do you prepare for it?
How do you prepare?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Okay, it's a good question for Sue.
I'm sorry, Heather. So how do you prepare to make the correct career choice at midlife?
Well, I think she'd like to avoid a crisis.
right.
I mean, she can see herself heading there. I mean, but what Heather was talking about was she had all the things on the go. She had the career, the house, that she's not married, and it all seems set up there that if she's not prepared for it in her 40s, whither her direction?
Right. I think one of the most important messages I hope to bring across was to really keep in mind the hopes and dreams and desires that have been part of you since your late childhood. Think about what you truly cared about when you were 11 and 12, and try to keep integrating those parts of yourself, your soul, if you will, into the life that you already have. You know, if you deeply cared about children, well, keep involved with children. You know, do volunteer work, be a foster parent. If you cared about wilderness adventure, as I did, make sure to keep that a part of your life. Women who have midlife crises tend to be those who neglect big chunks of themselves. They're women who get way over-involved in one part of their lives. They embrace too rigid a lifestyle. Those significantly raise the likelihood that you'll have one. And my hope with my book is that fewer women will have one because they are aware of the need to live sort of broad, well-rounded lives.
I'd like to see if we can squeeze in one more caller here from Ironwood, Michigan. Nancy, you're on the line.
Hi.
Hi.
I totally believe in this midlife crisis. I endured one and had one, and it totally changed my life. I had a divorce when I was 38. Then I was in the legal profession and became a flight attendant all of a sudden in the middle of nowhere, and it was almost like I could feel I had to do this. It's almost like I had no control over it. I was worried about the pension situation, all that type of thing, and I've never regretted it. I'm so glad I did it, even with the problems we've had in the airlines. I know I would have spent my whole life thinking, I wish I had done that.
But it's such a non-intuitive choice. How did you come up with flight attendant? Was there a yen to travel?
Oh, yes, very much.
And it had been there from the beginning.
And I actually applied to do that when I was 20 years old.
Yeah.
And got into the training. And then for other circumstances, I ended up getting married instead. And 25 years later, I came back to it.
That's fabulous. That's great, Nancy.
We're going out on a good news story. Nancy Kane, a last comment to you there. There seems to be some argument made, and Sue certainly mentions it quite a few times in her book, to pay attention to the loves and the things that we were passionate about when you were young, because they don't go away.
You know, it strikes me that compartmentalization is actually our enemy.
Aren't
here.
We good at it, though?
We're good. Americans are particularly good at it, right? We play and we work and we're outdoors and we're indoors and we have everything in nice, neat little files, Pendaflex files. And the underlying message, I think, one of the very important ones of Sue's book, and it's not inconsistent with lots of smart therapeutic and psychological and just good old common sense about living well is, you know, it's a big stew. Don't eat your potatoes separate from your carrots and your red wine and your beef. You know, it's a big coq au vin. And you want to pay attention to the carrots that you love and those small white onions, right? And that succulent chicken breast, at all the different moments.
Oh, now we all have to go out and eat something,
that's
Nancy.
Lovely.
Thank you both so much. That's all the time we have for this evening, and thank you both really for joining us. It's been a fascinating discussion. We've been speaking with Sue Shellenberger, creator and writer of the Wall Street Journal's Work and Family column. Her new book is The Breaking Point: How Female Midlife Crisis is Transforming Today's Women. And with me in studio was Nancy Kane, tonight's On Point News analyst. She's a professor at Harvard Business School and a business historian. Thank you both. Continue the conversation online. You can go to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, a new mom reflects on the political wrangling over so-called life issues. I'm Jennifer Westaway. This is On Point. Issues related to the so-called culture of life have dominated American domestic politics over the past several months, from the Terri Schiavo case to the war in Iraq to battles over judicial nominees. Massachusetts resident Tiziana Deering has been frustrated with the rhetoric she's heard from both sides of the recent debates over life issues. In this radio diary, she says the recent birth of her son has made her look at life in a whole new light.
I had a baby a week ago. When you deliver a baby, you become overwhelmingly aware of both the robustness and the fragility of life. You feel how robust life is in the brute strength of the kicking and pushing going on inside you. But you are also struck by life's fragility as you pray helplessly that the heartbeat you're hearing over the monitor won't slow down or stop before the baby is delivered. It's within this context that I've been watching so much of what's happening in politics of late. The country has been talking a lot about life, and somehow the conversation seems so much cheaper than the real thing. There's been the Terri Schiavo case, and more recently the death of the Pope, the Supreme Court ruling against execution of minors, the battles around appointing pro-life judges, new revelations of murder and torture of prisoners of war. All of these are serious issues, but all of these have been hijacked in one way or another, and by one side or the other, to promote what seems less about a culture of life and more about pure political agenda. One side has chosen fear-mongering. They seem to argue that life is so fragile, its flutter so tenuous, that it has to be defended with a fierceness, a zealotry, a kind of meanness that seems to give no credence to life's robust, nearly indestructible essence. And the other side seems so afraid to give ground to its opponents that it denies any fragility at all. All questions of life, at any stage, seem to get treated cavalierly, as if any qualm, any instinct to reach out a protecting hand, is fundamentally both ideological and traitorous. Well, I don't buy either side. I couldn't possibly, especially not while that sense of strength and delicacy that holding a tiny but screaming new baby sears into you is still with me. And enough of us are parents, have families, or care for those who are sick or dying that I don't think most of us buy either side entirely. I believe most of us understand, better than we're given credit for, both sides of the stories we've been hearing. Just as any mother would understand how inevitable the baby I carried felt to me in the last weeks, and at the same time, how much his hold on life seemed horribly tenuous until I heard his first cry and held him in my own arms. Life is not a wedge issue. It's what we have in common with all its nuance. And I can tell by the way people look at me and my newborn these days, with a mixture of joy and empathy, that those of us not stuck in a turf war understand that completely.
Tiziana Deering lives in Bedford, Massachusetts, with her husband, her daughter, and her newborn son, Jude. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Imada, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Tim Skog, Michael Garth, and Angel Coselli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Jennifer Westaway, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.